Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Thanks for being here with us on this Thursday afternoon. It's open forum, 2 hours of open forum with Jimmy Akin. The number to call, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, you got a question about the Bible, you got a question about Jesus, all of that is welcome. But when Jimmy's here, he'll talk to you about just about anything. If you got a question for Jimmy Akin, pick up that phone and call 888-318-7884. Jimmy, the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book, A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, and a bunch of other stuff. Also the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and senior apologist, more than 25 years under his belt here at Catholic Answers.
30.
Oh, man, that's right. The show is 25. You're 30 years here. Well, congratulations again on that. Welcome, Jimmy Akin.
My pleasure, Cy Kellett.
And what's dropping tomorrow on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
We're going to be looking at flying snakes. So
that's right.
It's a cryptid hunt. Flying snakes are discussed by a variety of figures in the ancient world, including the Greek historian Herodotus, who actually said he saw a big pile of their bones. And they're also mentioned by the prophet Isaiah and others as well. So we're going to be talking about flying snakes and what could be behind the reports of them.
All right. Flying snakes tomorrow on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. I want to ask you about it, but I know you're going to be like, no, tune in tomorrow and listen, because I have very specific questions. But I won't do it. I'll listen. I'll get my news on the flying snakes same time as everybody.
No, they were not native to the United States, so you don't have to worry.
Okay. All right. Nor Ireland, I would assume. Is it true that does Ireland really not have snakes?
Well, that's what they say. I've never actually looked to check.
No.
But maybe.
All right. Again, 888-318-7884. The number open forum means open. And that means you can call. You don't have to worry. Right now, you don't have to worry about holding anybody up because there's three lines open. But whatever your question, we would love to take it. 888-318-7884. Anonymous is in New York listening on the Catholic Answers app. You're starting us off, Anonymous. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, good evening. Hi, Jimmy. So I recently read through your Tiptoe Through Tulip article, which is a big read. I'm having trouble reconciling how Catholics can hold to unconditional election. And I trust it because I see Aquinas' comments and Augustine. But I don't see how that doesn't logically conclude with double predestination. And then also, if it's possible, an additional step, how does that tie in with the Catechism saying that God considers every person's free response to his grace? Does that make sense, Jimmy? Thank you.
Yeah, so I should probably provide a little bit of background for listeners who may not be familiar with all of this. In Calvinist Christianity is known for having five distinctive teachings, and these are commonly remembered in English by an acronym, which is TULIP, T-U-L-I-P. And T stands for total depravity, U stands for unconditional election, L stands for limited atonement, I stands for irresistible grace, and P stands for perseverance of the saints. And back in the 1990s, right after I became a Catholic apologist, I wrote a paper exploring how close one could get to the Calvinist understanding of TULIP and yet still be faithful to Catholic teaching. And I, in particular, relied on the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas, who in many but not all respects is close to TULIP. Also, St. Augustine is similar in many but not all respects to Calvinism. And I've always meant to write a balance piece of how far away you could get from TULIP and remain faithful to Catholic teaching. Unfortunately, I haven't yet done that, but hopefully at some point I will. Now, the particular doctrine that Anonymous is asking about is unconditional election. And this is a term that is used to refer to the idea that God unconditionally elects or unconditionally chooses certain people to be saved on the last day. And By unconditional, they mean there's no basis for it outside of God's free decision. God freely decides this person's going to go to heaven on the last day, and that person is therefore said to be unconditionally elected, because it was the choice or election was not based on anything other than God's free choice. So there were no conditions on it. It's not like this person had to have faith before God elected them, or they had to be foreseen to do good works in order for God to choose them, or anything like that. And you can be a Catholic and hold to unconditional election. Both St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas did hold this view, and it has not been condemned by the Catholic Church. It has been discussed, and not everybody agrees to it, but a few hundred years ago, during what were known as the controversies on grace, the Pope basically called a timeout and said the different Catholic scholars who were debating these issues could no longer accuse each other of heresy. And he said he'd get around to settling the issue of who's right later. But he never got around to settling it. So we've had a timeout on this subject for more than two centuries now. And so that's kind of the current state of play. As a Catholic, you can believe in unconditional election, but you don't have to believe in unconditional election. In terms of what Anonymous is asking about is, how could you hold unconditional election without falling into what's known as double predestination? Double predestination is another term of art, and it's used to refer to the idea that God not only predestines certain people to be saved on the last day, he also actively predestines certain people to be lost on the last day. So there are two forms of predestination. Either God just picks you and says, I want this person to be saved on the last day, and I'm going to make sure that happens. And God also picks somebody else and says, I want to make sure this person is damned on the last day, and consequently, I'm going to make sure that happens. And this is a position, double predestination, that the church does reject. So you're not being faithful to Catholic teaching if you hold double predestination. So the question is, how could God unconditionally choose certain people to be saved on the last day without him also choosing certain other people to be lost on the last day? And there's a standard answer to this, including in some Calvinist circles, which is that there's a difference in the mode of predestination between the two parties. According to this view, what happens is God actively chooses certain people to be saved, but he does not actively choose other people to be damned. He merely passes over those people. And so the predestination is not double in the sense of God is actively choosing both the saved and the lost. He's actively choosing the saved, and he's just passing over everybody else who ends up lost as a consequence of that decision. Now, whether this is a satisfying solution or not, It would seem to solve the dilemma here. However, many people would look at it and say, you know, I don't think this is a good solution. It seems to me that this is, even though there is a distinction here between actively saving some people and passively losing other people, it still all boils down to a choice that God made. And so even if you're saying he's not actively choosing who's going to get damned, he's passively choosing who's going to get damned. And so a lot of people would not find this a promising solution. And I would tend to, especially these days, I would tend to say I don't find it a promising solution either. I recognize that it's a possible solution, but I don't think it's a particularly good one. And this is one of the challenges for people who would hold a Thomistic view of this. Because if you start holding the viewpoint that St. Thomas argued, which is a permissible one, it generates some perplexities of how do we retain human freedom in this? How do we explain why God is not the author of evil. And non-Thomists would look at the Thomistic solution to these questions and say, I don't think they've made it. I don't think they're successfully avoiding these problems. Whereas people who are Thomists would say, no, I think these solutions do avoid the problems with the position. So it's really in the eye of the theologian as to whether or not they think the Thomistic position solves the problems or whether it doesn't. And personally, I would tend to say, I don't really think it does.
Anonymous, thank you very much for that call and for that question. It's Open Forum. Jimmy Akin's our guest. We got to take our first break. Right back with more Open Forum after this.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you ready to spread your wings? Wings is the weekly newsletter that's packed with exclusive news, program information, features, and updates of all that's going on at the Global Catholic Network. To sign up, go to EWTN.com, click subscribe, enter your name and email address, and you'll start getting your wings every week. Get your wings today. It's the weekly newsletter from EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's Open Forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and your call is welcome. 888-318-7884. Richard is in Santa Paula, California, listening on the app, the Catholic Answers app. Richard, thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy. The question is in regards to the Old Testament, you know, from Genesis onwards, in regards to the number of wives. That God allowed, and it came up in our CIA class. And so the curiosity is, you know, why did God allow, you know, multiple wives?
Okay.
At that time?
Well, I think we're not explicitly told why God allowed multiple wives in the Old Testament, but I think we can have a pretty good guess at why. One of the things we can tell from human biology is that at least in the main, people should have one spouse of the opposite sex. And the reason for that is that the sexes are born in equal numbers. 50% of the population is male and 50% of the population is female. So if every man had four wives, then you'd have 25% of the male population having 100% of the female population as wives. And that would mean that 3/4 of the male population would not have any wife at all. And so that might be okay in some species, where if you have a limited group of people or a limited group of organisms, you know, one of them gets all of the mates. You know, there are species like that. Bees are an example where the queen bee gets to mate with all of the drones. So she's got multiple husbands. She's got 100% of the husbands, even though she's only one of the females. Similarly, there are other species where, let's say you've got a herd of animals and one of the dominant male basically gets to breed with all of the females. Subordinate males don't get to do that. An example of that off the top of my head might be chickens, you know, where you have one dominant rooster who gets all of the hens. I'd have to check that to see if that's 100% accurate, but that would be an example. But humans don't cotton to that. If you've got three men in a human society, if you got four men in a human society and three of them don't get wives, but one of them gets four wives, the other three men are going to view that unfavorably, and it's going to lead to fights and competition between the men for wives. And so from that fact, from the way the psychology and the sex ratio of our species works, you can infer that at least on average, humans are meant to have one spouse of the opposite sex. Monogamy is God's fundamental plan. And we see that reflected in Scripture, where God creates Adam and Eve, not Adam and Eve and Barbara. So Adam had only one wife. And Jesus even points to this when he's questioned about divorce. He's asked, under what circumstances may a man divorce his wife? And in context, it would mean divorcing one wife and marrying another. And Jesus said that, you know, essentially divorce was created by human beings, but it was not so from the beginning. And he holds up the example of the Genesis narrative as an expression of God's will. God made Adam and Eve. He didn't make Barbara, so there's no one else for Adam to marry. And therefore, divorce is ruled out. Adam couldn't divorce Eve and marry somebody else. He's got Eve. She's the one God provided for him, and so he needs to stick with her. And in the same way, Jesus is arguing, every man needs to stick with the wife that's provided for him. Now that, of course, doesn't mean that there aren't situations where spouses cannot live together. But if you do get a civil divorce, you wouldn't be permitted under divine law to marry somebody else. Well, given that, if Adam can't divorce because Adam's only been given the one wife, Eve, then Adam also couldn't have multiple wives because there's no Barbara in this scenario. He's just got Eve. So it's not just that divorce is not God's plan. It's that monogamy is God's plan. So why then would God allow the Israelites to do things like divorce or have multiple wives? Well, Jesus gives us an answer to the first question, why would God allow divorce? He says, because your hearts were hard. Men in the ancient world were not committed to God enough that they would swear off divorce. And so God allowed them to continue to divorce women. He instituted some regulations to help protect the women that got divorced, but he allowed the Israelites to continue to divorce women because they weren't prepared to give it up. And if that's the answer for why God allows divorce in the Old Testament, I think it also applies to why he allowed polygamy in the Old Testament. The principles are the same in both cases. God made Adam and Eve, not Adam and Eve and Barbara. From that, you can infer that God allowed divorce because the Israelites' hearts were hard. And I think you can legitimately infer from that that God allowed polygamy because the Israelites' hearts were hard. They lived in an ancient Near Eastern culture where polygamy was permitted, and they weren't prepared to give it up. So God tolerated it for a time. Then when Jesus came, Jesus revealed the fullness of God's will, which allows for neither divorce, you know, with the right to remarry, or polygamy. And so I think that even though we're not explicitly told why God allowed polygamy in the Old Testament, I think that based on the principles that Jesus articulates, we have a very good guess that the reason is because the Israelites' hearts were hard and they simply weren't prepared to give up polygamy, just like they weren't prepared to give up divorce.
Richard, thank you. Thank you very, very much. All the lines full. On we go. Austin's in New York watching on YouTube. Austin, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello. So my question is, if good is convertible with being, and evil is a privation of good, then how can, like, evil be anything at all? And if evil is a privation of good, then it seems like it has no purpose or, like, meaning. So,
okay, so according to people who use this form of analysis, where they say good is a privation of, being and goodness are convertible and evil is a privation of good, they will bite the bullet and say, well, therefore evil is not a thing. Evil is something that we can talk about, but it's not like it has an independent reality. I'm going to use a fancy word here. The word is ontological, and it means what's ultimately real. It's a synonym for metaphysics. So they would say evil is not ultimately a thing. It's not metaphysically real. It's not ontologically real. It's a quality, or it's a description that we use to describe the quality of lacking something that is needed. And so it's evil, properly speaking, would be a lack, something that doesn't exist, rather than something that has its own independent reality. It's kind of like the hole in a donut. If you have a donut, and Psychelet, I'm sure you can speak to this with your expertise, but if you have a donut and it's got a hole in the middle of it, the hole is not an independent thing. It's not like there's an object. If you took away the rest of the donut,
and then there would be a hole sitting there.
Let's say you ate it.
I've done this experiment.
Yeah.
I've taken away a whole donut, no hole left.
And you don't have a hole left over. So the hole is not a thing. But that doesn't mean we can't still talk about the hole in a donut. Obviously we can, because we've just been doing it. But what the hole is a lack of something good, namely some sweet dough in the center that the donut doesn't have. And evil is kind of the same way. It's like a donut hole, but it is, it's a lack rather than something that positively exists on its own. As to the second question, if evil is a privation, what purpose does it have? Well, maybe we can use the model of a donut to help explain that. I actually don't know if there's a structural reason why donuts have holes. It may have been that they were easier to fashion that way. For example, now I do know that originally donuts did not have the modern round shape. Instead, they were like a twisted piece of bread and one of dough. And one of the advantages of that was it made them easy to turn as you were frying them. In fact, they even would turn themselves. And I remember an incident, I think it was in the Little House on the Prairie novels or books, which are actually loosely autobiographical. They're actually have novelistic aspects. They're not literal truth in all cases. but I seem to remember in the Little House books at one point, Ma Ingalls is looking at modern round donuts and dismissing them because they're not self-turning like the twisted ones. And she thinks it's a waste of time to have to monitor your donuts and hand flip them. But there could be some advantages to having them in a round form. One would be that it's going to enable them to cook more evenly and quickly. If they have a hole in the center of them, then they're going to have increased surface area, as opposed to if it was just a flat disc. And so if you're frying it, it will be easier to get the heat to the center of the donut because there's no hole in it. And so you're going to heat it more quickly and more evenly. And so there can be a purpose to having a donut hole in this way. And in the same way, there are purposes for evil. For example, physical evil, or one of the most prominent forms of which is pain, is actually good for us because it alerts us to danger. There are people who have what's known as congenital insensitivity to pain, and they have to be super careful because if they don't feel pain, they don't know when they're in danger in some situations. If a dog bites them, they don't necessarily know that. If they cut their hand open with a knife, they don't know that, and they may bleed and lose a lot of blood or get infected. And so our pain receptor nerves, what are known as nociceptors in medicine, actually play a valuable function. They alert us to danger and motivate us to deal with it. When it comes to other forms of evil, like moral evil, well, we have a pretty good guess at why God allows that. It's to allow a free choice between love and not love. Love is God's highest priority. That's the two biggest commandments, love God and love your neighbor. But love isn't the same if it's not freely chosen, if we were just programmed like robots to act in a loving manner. And so God tolerates moral evil, where people choose not to be loving, in order to let us have the good of freely choosing love, which gives it more meaning. Fundamentally, the Catechism says that God would not allow any evil unless he was planning to bring an equal or greater good out of it. So the purpose for which God allows evil is to enable a greater good, whether that good is avoiding danger or freely choosing love or something else that we may not even be able to know in this life.
I'm going to say thanks, Austin. Thanks very much for that question. But we have come now to the time for the break, so we will have to take that break. The number is 888-318-7884-888-31-TRUTH. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, maybe you have a question about morals or philosophy, we've gotten into some of that already, or maybe you have another question, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, our guest, both hours back right after this with more Open Forum. Excitement is building for Catholic Answers Annual Apologetics Conference, I Believe in God. There's still time to join us September 21st through 24th in sunny San Diego as we welcome Scott Hahn and an all-star lineup of speakers, as well as your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. Join us for a conference that is sure to ignite, encourage, and inform your faith. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
What if the voice of your deepest doubts about Catholicism rose up in the form of a human being and challenged you to defend your most foundational beliefs? That's the task apologist Trent Horn took upon himself in his new book, Devil's Advocate, a dialogue with his own best objections against the faith that he professes and defends. You can stand up against your doubts, and Trent will show you how. Pick up your copy of Devil's Advocate today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
This is Dr. David Anders. Are your friends or family discouraging you from becoming Catholic?
We can help on Call to Communion tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. There's a little Thursday groovy music for you. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's open for him, and lines have been staying pretty full. Let me check the lines right now and let you know if there's lines open. Not at the moment, but keep trying. 888-318-7884. Lines do open up. Becky is in Morgantown, West Virginia, listening on Light of Life Radio. Becky, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello, Jimmy. Thanks for taking my call. I have an elderly friend that was admitted to the hospital with many problems, and so they have decided to take all support off of him and just give him pain meds. My question is, he's been in this state since Monday. I think the family just, we all expected him to go rather soon. That hasn't happened. He seems to somewhat know us, not opening his eyes or speaking, but grinning or squeezing our hand. I just don't know what to pray for anymore. I don't want him to go. I'd like to have a miracle, but I'm at a loss as to what to do.
Well, you're certainly free to pray for a miracle. You can always do that. You can ask God to heal him and give him more life and allow him to be restored to good health. There's nothing wrong with praying that. So you can do that, but you may also need to, you will also need to recognize that it may not be God's will. As a fallback, you can also pray for a smooth passing for him, that he'll be able to pass on peacefully and free of pain and be able to make progress quickly towards God in the afterlife. And since you, if you don't know which of those is best for him, you can leave it up to God. You can say, you know, Heavenly Father, please give my friend whatever help he needs, whatever will be best. If that's a miracle, I'd love it to be a miracle. If it's not a miracle, if that's not what's best for him, then I would ask you to help make his passing easy and gentle and bring him to you swiftly. And so since we don't know what to pray for, we can leave that up to God. We can, you know, sketch out the possibilities that occur to us, and we can express a preference for what our preference would be. But since we ultimately don't know what's best in a situation, we can and should, you know, leave that up to God. This is something, incidentally, that St. Paul refers to in the book of Romans. If you read Romans chapter 8, Paul talks about how God works all things for the good of those that love him, but he also talks about how the Holy Spirit intercedes for us with inexpressible groans when we don't know what to pray. So not knowing what to pray for is a human experience that has been recognized since the beginning of Christianity, and we have, according to St. Paul, the help of the Holy Spirit in that situation, who also intercedes for us in ways that go beyond human understanding. So you can call upon the Holy Spirit and ask for him to intercede for your friend along with you, and to provide whatever form of help and assistance your friend most needs at this time.
Thank you very much, Jimmy. That softens my heart and helps me a great deal.
Good. And we'll also ask all the listeners to pray both for your friend and for you and your friend's family and for everyone in similar situations.
Thank you, Jimmy.
Thank you. Thank you, Becky. Thank you very much for the call. We'll go now to Pauline in Round Top, Montana, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Pauline, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. I am a spiritually gifted Catholic, and I have feel like I have not really had support from the church or direction on what I should or should not be doing. I have two grandchildren that are also gifted, and I would love to see more support for them as they grow up than I feel I got myself. I know the church doesn't have an official stance on this. I've looked every place that I possibly can. But why is that we don't have help?
Well, you know, there are human limitations, and the church wants to help people in all the ways it can, but it's subject to human limitations. We all have, you know, limited amounts of time, and more importantly, we have limited amounts of information. And there are places in the church that help people cultivate their spiritual gifts and exercise their spiritual gifts, regardless of what those are. It's just a question of finding one. And there may or may not be some in your area. There may be some that you just haven't come into contact with. There may not be. There certainly are groups that, you know, could work with you or your grandchildren at a distance, you know, because today we're blessed to have telecommunications that enable us to communicate over great distances. And there are groups to help. If you don't mind my asking, what sort of spiritual gifts do you display?
Well, I see angels. A lot of times I see angels in different places. As an 8-year-old child, I lost one of my best friends. Her sister was expecting, and I just loved her to pieces, and she died in childbirth.
Oh.
And this was my very first funeral, and I went to the funeral, and I was arguing with my dad. I wanted to go up and say goodbye to her, and he did not think that was a grand idea. And as her mother walked over, she appeared beside her mother and said, "No, sweetheart, you stay here, and you remember me like this. I'm okay."
Uh-huh.
And I found that very comforting.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and this was just one of a number of experiences like this that you've had?
Yes, I have. Okay. I have actually had premonitions that have come true. When I met my husband, I heard a voice that said, "This is your husband," and I was most unhappy because I didn't care for the friend that introduced him, and I thought he was probably like him. But we've been married for 50 years, happily raising our family Catholic, and but I've had lots of things like that happen to me. I've also, if I go to a, I'm not fond of going to battlegrounds or museums because sometimes there are spirits attached to things. And I see those.
Okay. Well, these are experiences that some people have. Not everybody has them, but they do occur. They're reported, fairly commonly. Actually, people don't realize how common these types of experiences are. The ones that you've described could all be explained in terms of what's known as an apparition. An apparition is where a departed spirit appears in some manner, and that could be a visible appearance. It could be an audible appearance, like when you heard the voice, and it could be both, you know, where you like both saw your friend and heard her. And there are, you know, situations where people who are not yet with God, they're in the afterlife, but they're still being purified. They may, as part of that purification process, still be located in, you know, or manifesting, appearing in a battlefield or a museum or something like that. And that's been reported down through Christian history in Catholic circles. As in terms of how to deal with this, there are different approaches. One is a scientific approach that would look at these phenomena in terms of parapsychology. And I happen to be trained as a parapsychological field investigator, so I can look at these from that perspective. Also, there are spiritual directors. And one of the most common things that has happened in Christian history when someone is experiencing visions and apparitions and things like that, and precognitions, is for them to get a spiritual director who can help them navigate through those experiences. And there also may be groups, you know, that focus on helping people with their spiritual gifts. But most people in this kind of situation would seek out a spiritual director who can help them get a religiously informed perspective on what they're experiencing. And so that's what I would recommend if you're interested in assistance, either for yourself or for your grandchildren. You know, you can talk to a spiritual director, you can talk to a parapsychological investigator, you can talk to both. But there is help available for understanding and processing these experiences in a supportive way.
And we'll leave it there, Pauline. Thank you very much for the call. I got to take another break, but thank you.
In fact, Pauline, if you'd like to talk to me further, give me an email. My email is jimmy@catholic.com.
Again, thank you, Pauline. We'll be right back with more Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
In Morse code, the sequence SOS is a distress call. It's been said that it stands for Save Our Souls. Well, right now our world is in big trouble, and we're putting out an SOS call for help. Will you answer that call? St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, has hundreds of teams who share the good news with souls who don't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to get involved.
Divine Intimacy Radio.
The greatest joy in my life is helping others to come to know Christ more fully. And there's no better light on this path, the path to deep union with God, than the wisdom of the saints. Talking about this daily on EWTN Radio is one of the great joys of my life.
Divine Intimacy Radio, Sunday, 6:30 a.m., 1:30 p.m., and 11 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and it is open forum. If you've got a question, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. Up next is Carlos up in Canada, listening on Catholic.com. That's our website, Catholic.com. Carlos, thank you very much for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you. Yeah, so I had a question regarding a very regrettable incident that seems to be on the news regarding Bishop Michael Olson from the Diocese of Fort Worth and a Carmelite monastery with the prioress. They seem to have been in a very bitter fight among them, and they just, on one hand, the nuns say they no longer recognize, you know, the bishop authority anymore because he's been abusing them. So in good conscience, they have to say that they don't longer recognize his authority and don't want him to enter the monastery property or have any contact or relations with anyone in the monastery because they are abusing from her or from them. And then the bishop says that what the nuns have done, issuing a public statement rejecting his authority as diocese bishop and pontifical commissioner, they may have incurred upon herself latae sententiae. I hope that's correct.
Latae sententiae, uh-huh. Okay.
And says that depending on their complicity in, you know, other nuns there, publicly scandalous and sinistic actions other nuns at the monastery could possibly have incurred the same excommunication. So my question is not so much who is right or not, because obviously we don't know and there's an ongoing investigation, but is it in principle possible for monastery nuns to do this? And can the bishop say, okay, if you don't recognize me, then this is what happens?
Okay, so I should probably clarify a term for listeners who may not be familiar with it. You mentioned the term latae sententiae excommunication. And so excommunication is a censure that the church imposes for certain kinds of ecclesiastical crimes. It doesn't mean you're not a Catholic anymore, but it does mean that you are suffering under certain limitations. Canonically, such that you, for example, cannot receive the sacraments and you can't legitimately exercise authority and a few other things like that. And there are two ways that a person can incur excommunication. One is the one you mentioned. It's known as latae sententiae excommunication. And you can translate that into English effectively. This is not a literal translation, but an effective translation for that is automatic. So merely by committing the crime under certain circumstances, you automatically excommunicate yourself. The other form of excommunication is known as ferendae sententiae, and you can kind of gloss that in English or effectively translate it in English as imposed or declared excommunication. And in this case, what happens is the competent authority, which is usually the local bishop, but it could be someone else, but the competent authority looks into the situation and says, yeah, they committed this crime, and so I'm going to impose the sentence of excommunication on them, whether or not they incurred it automatically. Now, and that has some additional effects beyond just what happens in a latae sententiae or automatic excommunication. In this case, now I'm aware of this case and I followed it somewhat. I have not looked it up recently, and so I'm not up to speed on all of the recent developments. You mentioned some that I'm not aware of one way or another. But if it's true that the nuns have said they no longer recognize the bishop's authority, and if it's true that the bishop has said that they may have excommunicated themselves latae sententiae, then I would have a question of precisely what was the ecclesiastical crime he thinks they committed that resulted in a laetae sententiae excommunication, because there's not very many of them. You know, if you lay hands on the Pope, meaning you physically attack the Pope, that's one of them. Another is knowingly and deliberately procuring an abortion. Another is, you know, taking the sacred species of the consecrated host or the precious blood in order to desecrate them. But there's not very many of these. Three are that are sometimes talked about are apostasy, heresy, and schism. Apostasy is the total renunciation of the Christian faith, but the nuns haven't done that. Another is embracing a teaching that is contrary or refusing to accept one of the dogmas of the church, but the nuns haven't done that. Another is saying, well, and schism is refusing submission to the Roman pontiff or refusing communion with those who are in communion with the Roman pontiff. But the nuns haven't refused submission to the Roman pontiff, not in any direct way. Neither have they refused communion with those who are in communion with the Pope. Now, of course, the bishop is in communion with the Pope, but saying, I don't recognize his authority is not the same thing as saying, I refuse communion with him. You can recognize, you know, you can be in communion with someone who doesn't have any authority over you. Like Cy Kellett. I'm in communion with Cy Kellett.
Yes.
But Cy Kellett does not have authority over me. So that shows us you can be in communion with someone without being in submission to their authority. I would suppose that what the bishop might be thinking of, since he has been appointed the apostolic, I forget the term, whether it's administrator or delegate to deal with this situation, but he's been appointed by the Holy See to deal with this situation. And I could see someone making an argument that if the nuns refuse his authority in this situation, then since his authority was specifically given to him by the Vatican to deal with this situation, that would be a refusal of submission to the Pope. And therefore, that could be an act of schism, which would incur laetae sententiae or automatic excommunication. I would not consider it certain. And one of the principles that's the case, that they've committed canon law, that they've committed laetae sententiae excommunicable offense, one of the principles of canon law is you have to, because it restricts rights, if someone is excommunicated, you have to give a favorable reading to the person in question. If you're going to restrict their rights in the church, you have to read the law strictly and not broadly in applying it. And so I could see a counter case arguing that even if they reject the authority of the bishop in this circumstance, the necessary conditions for that to constitute a refusal of submission to the Roman pontiff may not have been met. And so I couldn't say with confidence that they did excommunicate themselves. And that may be consistent with what you report the bishop is saying, Carlos, that they may have committed it, but not that they did for a fact. And that could be a reasonable assessment. But I can say that given the situation and how it evolves, the nuns hypothetically could excommunicate themselves, or they could have an imposed excommunication for a sufficiently grave crime.
Carlos, I'm going to leave that one there. I thank you very much for the call and for the question. I think we'll move on to David in Ontario, Canada. Another Canada call, listening on the Catholic Answers app. David, go ahead with your question. Hang on, I just got to get you to the phones. David, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Paul, I really appreciate it. I just had a question for Jimmy. What is your best defense for the existence of purgatory when you're speaking with some of our Protestant friends?
Well, I typically point out a few things. One of them is that... Ooh, there's an interesting noise. One of them is that even though they don't recognize the book of 2 Maccabees as canonical, 2 Maccabees does endorse the practice of praying for the departed. And that implies that our prayers can help the departed in some way, which implies some kind of process in the afterlife where there can be remaining effects of sin. Now, our Protestant friends don't recognize 2 Maccabees as canonical, but they do recognize it as a book that was written by Jews before the time of Christ. And so that shows us that the principles of purgatory just being a modern name for this post-mortem purification from the consequences of sin, it shows us that the idea of purgatory is there in the Judeo-Christian faith even prior to the time of Christ. And it's still in Judaism. Jewish people still pray for their departed loved ones. And the practice just continued in the Christian community as well, because it was already there before the time of Christ. St. Paul, in 1 Corinthians 3, alludes to a situation where everyone's works are going to be tested by fire. And if the works survive this fire, then the person will receive a reward. But if the person's works are consumed, the person will still be saved. So we're not talking about the damned here. It's the saved. The person will still be saved, but it will be like escaping through flames. Well, Psychelet, is escaping through flames fun?
I don't want to do it.
Yeah, well, it's better than not escaping, but
right.
But it's still not fun. And so this would indicate that even for saved believers, there can be a process in the afterlife that is not entirely fun, but that some people are going to go through on their way to their final state. And that 1 Corinthians is recognized by Protestants as canonical. I also would point out that in Christianity, prayer for the dead, which implies, again, whether it implies that our prayers can help them in some way. So it implies the existence of a process after death where we can help people, is universal in Christianity, except in the Protestant community. So what you see is it's in Judaism, it's in Catholicism, it's in Eastern Orthodoxy, it's in Oriental Orthodoxy, it's everywhere except in the Protestant community. And that would give Protestants a reason to rethink their position on this issue. Unless they have a good disproof of purgatory, maybe they want to go with the view of Jews and Christians generally, which, based on the two passages I've just mentioned, is supported either in Scripture, in the case of 1 Corinthians, or at least, and in addition to 1 Corinthians, it's also supported in Judeo-Christian literature from before the time of Christ, as in the case of 2 Maccabees. The ultimate thing, though, that I think is most successful in helping Protestants reconsider this issue is to just talk about our experience as Christians. God, when we become Christians, helps us grow in holiness over the course of the Christian life, but most of us are not completely holy at the moment of our deaths. We still have disordered desires and attachments to things, and yet we know we're going to be holy in God's presence. When we're in heaven, we're not going to be tempted by sin. We're not going to be sinning. We will be perfectly holy in heaven. And that tells us that between the moment of death and the moment we're in heaven, there has to be a purification, a final rush of sanctification. And we just give the name purgatory to that. It may happen in the twinkling of an eye, but one way or another, it needs to happen to us if we're going to make the jump from being not fully holy Christians to fully holy saints in heaven. And typically Protestants can look at that and say, you know, you're right. I may not call that purgatory, but that has to take place.
David, thanks very much for the call, for the question. Lots of folks on the line. If you're on the line, hang on the line. If you haven't called yet, perfect time to dial 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and we continue with Open Forum right after this on Catholic Answers Live.